The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Silicon Valley Bank UK. Hello and welcome to The Extraordinary Ordinary, the podcast from Women of the Year, where we get to know the stories of remarkable women you've probably never heard of, but whose passion and hard work have changed lives, society, and even the world in all kinds of ways. I'm Mojo Abidi, I'm a journalist and the presenter of this very special podcast, and today I'm here with Karen Dark. Karen has always been passionate about exploring the great outdoors, but when she was just 21 years old, she fell while climbing a sea cliff. The life-changing accident left her paralyzed from the chest down, but she didn't let that stop her from doing what she loved the most, going on adventures. She has since skied across ice caps, hand-cycled the world's biggest mountain ranges, and even become a British Paralympic gold medalist. Karen is now gearing up for her biggest adventure yet, a record-breaking journey across the Antarctic. It will be the first time any woman who can't walk has been to the South Pole and will be an enormous mental challenge as well as a physical one. Karen, welcome to the Extraordinary Ordinary podcast. It's wonderful to have you here.
Thank you, Mojo.
Now, in a few months' time, you're going to be doing something pretty incredible. You're going on a record-breaking trip to Antarctica. Can you tell me all about that?
Yeah, so this is a long time coming. It's been about 10 years or so. And I guess originally it stemmed from wanting to go to Antarctica, this a beautiful, amazing continent. And of course, there's still some of that. The chance to visit this precious continent is a real privilege. And I really, really feel that 10 years on when I realize the challenges that our planet faces, particularly environmentally. And also, you know, how challenging it is to get to this place and to survive in this place. Extreme wilderness and extreme costs to get there. So it's always felt important to go there, that going is telling a story or exploring something which could be beneficial to people, you know, on a wider basis that can't go to Antarctica. So that's where we've got to 10 years later from the original concept. And this winter, we will indeed be finally going down to Antarctica. So we really want to go and tell a story about the value of nature.
And where does that passion for nature come from?
I guess my passion for that stems from my journey becoming paralyzed. It's only my mental health and my happiness has been absolutely fundamentally enabled by being in nature. And that began at the very beginning. I remember being in hospital, asking if I could have my bed wheeled outside the hospital after 3 months of just looking at polystyrene ceiling tiles and being really stuck indoors. And I just spent a whole day just looking at leaves on a tree over my bed and the blue sky, and it was transformational. And I think in that moment I realized the absolute innate power of nature to heal us. And maybe I knew that inherently anyway, but I hadn't quite registered it. And since then, that's just moved to greater depths and more profundity, if you like. So that's really the story that's behind this exploration of Antarctica.
I've never actually met anyone who's been to Antarctica, so you'll be the first. Can you tell us about the logistics of your trip? You know, how you're going to get there, what you're going to be doing there?
So the logistics are complicated. In fact, this morning I spent some time looking into the logistics. It's a long, long way away, obviously. There are very limited ways to get there. And one of those is with a company called Antarctic Logistics. There are one or two of them that operate in Antarctica so that people like myself can get into the interior of Antarctica. But essentially, we will fly to South America, and we are offsetting all of our carbon impact with planting trees. And then we will arrive in Antarctica at the edge of the continent at a place called Union Glacier. And then we'll travel from there across the interior and take a journey I will have to travel by either a bike, well, it's a tricycle, which I pedal with my arms with huge, big fat tires on. This is also happens to be a big advance in technology and will be a world first that anybody in my position has attempted to hand cycle across the Antarctic plateau to the pole. And if that doesn't work for some reason, because of the technology or the snow conditions or the ice conditions, then I'll revert to using what's called a sit ski, which is parallel skis that I'll sit on in a little seat and then pull myself along with a lot of difficulty with my arms. But thankfully, I've got a couple of strong teammates as well, so they'll help, no doubt, because it's probably an impossible mission to do it all alone.
That is going to be a seriously tough challenge, not just physically, but mentally too, right?
It is, and to be honest, it's probably the culmination of my whole life that will hopefully enable me to have that mental agility to cope with it. I did cross the Greenland ice cap about 15 years ago now, and that was at that point in time absolutely the toughest mental thing I'd ever done. It was so challenging physically, mentally, not just for the usual things you'd expect from managing your body and moving across the ice every day for 10 hours a day, but also the added challenges of my disability. So being paralyzed from the chest down means that my temperature regulation doesn't work. So my brain can't transmit messages via my nerves to my blood vessels to constrict and dilate. So I can get cold very, very easily. I have to go to the toilet differently to people normally. So that's also a huge challenge. I have to use water to go to the toilet and catheters to urinate. So there are lots of medical technology challenges associated with it as well to stay safe and healthy, and probably testing all these products out in environments that they've never ever been tested in before. So quite interesting on all aspects, really.
It sounds like you'll have a good team going with you, though. Can you tell us about the people you're going with?
Well, it's a good team, and the team has changed, actually, which is interesting. So originally the team was myself and a young woman called Iona Somerville, who was involved in Women of the Year last year. And Iona was in the Manchester Arena bombing when she was just a teenager and has suffered a lot of PTSD. However, she was also part of a Scottish project with a charity called the Polar Academy, who take young people and give them an exposure to nature and training as part of a team for a project to take a ski journey in Greenland. So Iona was part of that as a teenager when she was about 14. Me and Iona have been the core team up until just a few weeks ago. And I have huge respect for Iona, because she's been through a really tough few years since Manchester. And she finally connected. She was feeling kind of frozen in response to, excuse the pun, but frozen in response to going to Antarctica, that kind of freeze symptom that we get when our systems are quite stressed. And she has finally connected it to Manchester and how that's triggering, you know, the thought of going to Antarctica, going into an environment where it's potentially unsafe, is triggering some of the trauma from Manchester. So at this point in time, Iona has decided that it's not the right place for her to go. And so respectful of that decision, because it's really easy in this world we live in to get sucked along with what we should do, or what we've said we'll do, or what others are demanding of us, or thinking of that we will do, or that we've already committed to. And I think it is really important to be really truthful and honest with ourselves, to really tune into what's true for us and what we're able to commit to, and what we're able to, the situations and environments that we're able to put ourselves into. And the last thing we can have in Antarctica is someone who's feeling really, really intimidated by that environment. So I think it's a great choice by Iona, a really difficult decision for her. But that does mean that the team now is not what we expected. It's myself with Professor Mike Christie, who's a specialist in this topic of value of nature, and Mike Webster, who's a filmmaker from Scotland, who'll be documenting the journey. And we will have a professional guide with us as well, just for extra strength and local knowledge. So hopefully we'll be a good team.
I'm sure you'll be a great team. For context, how long will the whole journey take you?
We'll be in Antarctica for just short of a month. The physical journey itself could be 3 weeks, maybe slightly quicker. It's really hard to predict. It really depends on the conditions of the ice, on whether there are any storms, how we respond to altitude, because Antarctic plateau is at 3,000 meters. And then with the polar effect, it feels like it's higher than that because the oxygen is thinner at the poles. So it'll be the equivalent of arriving at 3,500 meters. So we don't know how we'll respond to all those conditions. And we want to give a bit of time to just start gradually and not stress our systems too much, and to really have time as well to have these conversations and go into how we're feeling, and also the people we might meet during our time in Antarctica, to explore these topics that we want to bring back and communicate with people about the value of nature.
A month really puts into perspective how big the Antarctic is.
I mean, it's enormous. You look at a map and it's a reminder of how enormous this universe is, and this planet and our continents, and we're just little specks in the middle of it all.
This trip is hopefully going to break a couple of records, isn't it? Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, they're kind of accidental. It wasn't ever the purpose of the trip, but in discussing it with the people at Antarctic Logistics, they pointed out that it would be the first time anyone with a disability like mine who's paralysed has crossed the plateau. There are a couple of guys, I think Americans, who have skied the last degree, so the last final degree into the pole, which is a shorter distance. So it'll be the first time any woman's ever, in my circumstances, have ever gone down there and done this. It'll be the furthest that anybody who's paralyzed has ever traveled, and also the first time anyone has ever tried to use a hand cycle. In fact, I think the truth is the first time anyone will have attempted to cycle, well, not attempted to, but if we're successful in using the cycle, it'll be the first time anyone, even able-bodied, will have cycled to the South Pole, not on an ice road. There's somebody that's done it, but they did it on a prepared ice road from the American base into the pole. So yeah, accidentally, if we're successful, it will be some world and Guinness records and things.
That is so exciting. You've touched on this a little bit, but I just want to ask again, what message do you hope your adventure to the South Pole will send to other people?
It's really about our mental health and well-being and how important nature has a role in that, but also how we can use our thoughts and our own abilities that we all have. It's really easy to think we don't, that we're not resilient, that we don't have the skills. But, you know, early on after becoming paralyzed, I learned that our thoughts are real forces. They can really impact how we feel. They really impact the neurochemistry that we're generating in our body. And so when people look at me and say, how do you do that? How would you ski there? Or how do you manage your life in a wheelchair? It's really about the ability that we all have. Our brain just has this capacity. We have this capacity between our brain and our heart, between our thoughts and our feelings, to really create any reality for ourselves. So that's one part of it. And then the other is around this value of nature, and just to explore what can we all do to benefit from nature more, and why does that impact us? Why does it have such a profound effect on us? But also that mutual respect for nature. How do we look after it better? And what can we do to really keep creating a planet that's more sustainable and where we can really look after the bigger picture instead of just our own individual little lives or whatever? And I know that that's, you know, we're flying to Antarctica, so there's a huge question mark around that in myself, which I've just really gone deep on about how can I justify this and how do we offset the impact. And it's a difficult one. We all want to do things in the world. We all want to travel. There's huge value in seeing other places and telling stories and exchanging stories. And that's, you know, super valuable. But how do we do that at the same time as minimizing our impact or doing things in a way that's somehow more respectful of the natural environment that we depend on so much, and that if we don't look after it, we're going to, you know, get more into trouble?
That is a really powerful message. I love that. Karen, as you've just mentioned, when you were 21, your life changed significantly. You were in an accident and became paralyzed. Would you mind telling us about that?
Sure. I mean, very briefly, I fell from a cliff in Scotland when I was rock climbing. I woke up 3 days later in intensive care to be told I was paralyzed from the chest down. And there began a whole new life. And it wasn't a life I wanted or anticipated. I think we never really imagine the worst, especially when we're younger. I certainly have gone into things and situations without considering potential consequences. That's partly my nature of character and partly maybe the nature of youth as well. But I was faced with a whole new life. Initially, really just a sense of, well, what can I do? And really thinking about all the things that I couldn't do anymore instead of all the things that I still could do. And I think that was a fundamental shift for me in mindset that helped, was to just take my focus away from what was impossible and what I couldn't do, and all the overwhelm and shock of that, to start to just look at, well, what can I still do and what might be possible? And those two questions alone start to open up a whole new world of possibility. So I think where we focus our thoughts is crucial. And when we can shift it towards possibility, then, because there always is something that we can do and some way that we can either contribute to the world or learn something or find some new insight, there's always something that we can do. So that question feels fundamental in navigating the tough challenges that life throws at us, whether that's becoming paralyzed or somebody who loses, is experiencing grief or some other very difficult circumstance that we all have to navigate at some point in time.
During that initial time after your accident, what were the things that gave you strength and helped you fight on?
Definitely going outside. As soon as I could get outside the hospital, even just for an hour, I started going sailing with one of the physiotherapists. So that, again, connection with movement of the body, with nature, and then, of course, people, having friends and family and people caring and coming to visit. I think fundamentally the answer would be connections to nature, connections to myself and my new body, and connections to people and the support that we get from that interaction with others and that sense of care and compassion and community that grows.
It's clear you've always really loved the outdoors. Was that a big motivator for you as well? Just a dream of having adventures again?
Yes, it was. And early on, I started to dream of adventures again. And I remember looking at a picture of the Himalayas that some friends had stuck above my bed in the hospital, thinking I couldn't go there anymore, and very quickly started to ask, well, actually, how could I go there? And what would that take? And what might that look like? And that led to having a handbike designed, which was a tandem, actually, which was for the first tandem hand cycle probably ever made. And that took me on a journey across the Himalayas a few years later.
That's amazing, because I read that the first thing you bought when you left the hospital was a race chair, right? Tell me about that.
Yeah, I knew I wanted to move my body, and I wasn't really into competition. It was just the obvious way to have some kind of gadget that would enable me to move in the outdoors in a different way, have my body in a different position. And I used to push it for miles through the Scottish Highlands along country lanes whilst my friends were up climbing mountains. That was my early purchase, and then that led to this hand cycle design, and it went on from there, really.
That's amazing. So you eventually went from this race chair to your hand cycling and a professional sporting career. Can you talk us through that journey?
Yeah, it wasn't quite as straightforward as that, to be honest. In fact, 15 years after I was paralysed before I decided to take up hand cycling and try and go to a Paralympic Games. So really, my love is to be outside in mountains and beautiful environments. And so my early career on becoming paralyzed outside of my job, I had another career, but my early life was very much around ways to get into the outdoors again.
Can you talk to us about some of the adventures you've had in these amazing environments, how you got back out into the great outdoors?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I was lucky that when I was paralyzed, I was a student. So I was in this environment full of people that were up for doing things. I met somebody who'd kayaked to Alaska, and I thought, wow, that sounds amazing. How might that be possible? So got a team of us together, two of us that were paralyzed, and we cycled from Vancouver in Canada all the way to Alaska over 3 months, which involved leaving our wheelchairs behind. I guess I've just always been surrounded by people that love the outdoors as well, and maybe a little bit crazy for adventures. So people are always saying to me, how about this? And I'm like the crash test dummy person that goes, yeah, all right, then that sounds good. And then it's a process of trying to figure out how. So crossing the Greenland ice cap, yeah. I went back to climbing again and climbed the overhanging cliff of El Capitan in America, which became famous through the film Free Solo. I've been back to the Himalayas about four times since then, to various parts of it, from Pakistan to India, Nepal, Tibet. And actually on Tuesday, I go to Bhutan, leading a group there to go and explore the kingdom of happiness and what that's all about, and what their philosophy is around happiness.
That all sounds amazing. You seem like the sort of person who is always on the go.
It seems to be that way. When it's the way you are, you don't realise how it's maybe a bit different to everybody else. But it does increasingly get pointed out to me that I seem to have lived 10 lives in one. And how do I do it? And there's a little slogan that somebody else I know actually introduced to me. And they said, as long as my ass is moving, I'm happy. And it feels a bit like that for me as well.
That's a great slogan. You say when you're outdoors, that's when you're at your happiest. Can you talk to us about that and how nature makes you feel?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to put it into words. It brings me a sense of peace, of calm, of freedom. Somehow when in being indoors, I just feel kind of somehow limited or a bit stuffy. It doesn't feel like as many things are possible. As soon as I go outside and walk around through nature, through a forest or by a river, I always see metaphor in nature. I always see shapes or processes that somehow represent to me what happens within us as humans. And there's actually quite a lot of research in environmental psychology which looks at why people heal more rapidly, for example, in a hospital if they can see images of nature, or if the colours used to paint a room are more natural, or if they can see a view of some plants or trees outside. There's actual evidence now that people do heal quicker. It's not just the psychological feeling of it. There is real, hard science and research that shows the impact that this is having on us. And there's various ideas around that, from phytochemicals that trees and plants emit, which actually strengthen our immune system, right through to the psychological impact of seeing wide spaces or big skies or bigger horizons.
I definitely agree with that. Whenever I'm having a bad day, I'm lucky enough to live by a park. And if I'm having a bad day and I just go for a walk through the park, I can instantly feel my mood improve. So I can't even imagine what something like a trip to the Himalayas would do for me.
Well, actually, today I was writing for I'm doing a group coaching session next week with a group all about a journey I took across Tibet in 2014, where there was a group of, I think it were five of us, five women, and we'd all had some really big life events happen, and everyone was pretty questioning their identity, and everyone was struggling a little bit with their well-being and their emotions around all the difficult things that happened, from, you know, job changes to relationship endings to health problems and all sorts. And I think we came back, all of us, just utterly transformed after a month of cycling through astounding mountain scenery and just incredible vistas and big skies and big horizons. And some days we would cycle and just absolutely pour tears, and some days we would laugh. But, you know, all these processes are so healing to us. But they're things that sometimes it's hard for us to take time out to do when we're busy or people have families and all the stresses of every day. It seems like the last thing that you would do, just to step out and take time out. But actually, it's so important to do that.
It's a shame, isn't it? Because people are so busy. Sometimes nature is right at the bottom of their priority list, even though it can really help you deal with the stress of everyday life.
Yeah. But I know that the impact of that, you know, sometimes we have to do something now that's valuable in the long term. It's really easy to just keep doing the immediate and focusing on the immediate demands. But so I have a little expression called sustainable stretch. How do we actually allow ourselves? You know, we talk about sustaining our planet and our environment, but how do we do that for ourselves as individuals? Most people are fairly wrung out and living in stress and anxiety and not taking enough time just to live in a way that's actually a bit more sustainable. And it's easy for me to say that, because I know people would look, friends that know me would look at me and go, but you can't go at your pace and do that. But actually, I do have some fundamental things wired in, which I refer to as being my rocks. And if I don't get them into each day regularly, then I know that I'll be in trouble. It's not sustainable. And nature is one of those. So
that's great. I'm going to think about what my rocks are after we finish talking.
Yeah.
Karen, I'd love to know more about your professional sporting career, because you competed and won medals in the London 2012 Paralympics and the Rio 2016 Paralympics. You won silver in London and gold in Rio, right? Which is just amazing. Can you tell me about that and how it felt to win a gold medal?
Yeah, I mean, it was almost an unexpected journey going to the Paralympics.
I didn't really anticipate going to two Paralympic Games or winning medals, etc. But it was an incredible journey.
I think throughout it, I was lucky to learn so much about maybe what I'd call more of a performance mindset. How do we get our body to be in the best shape possible? How do we get our muscles and our physical body to be in good shape? But it requires being in good shape at every level to win medals at an Olympics. So not just physically, but mentally, emotionally, everything from the detail of nutrition and sleep and what I call positive psychology basics, but, you know, really focusing on how we can keep bringing our mind back to the best version of itself, how we can coach ourselves and be our best coach to ourselves, berating ourselves for never being good enough.
Just to put yourself down that you're never going to do it. But actually, if we're telling ourselves stories that don't support us in our missions or our journeys in life, then we absolutely won't do them. So it's like, well, how do we change those stories that we tell ourselves to make them something which enables us to potentially achieve those dreams and goals that we want to, that we're working towards, or to be the person we want to be? So I think it's important, not just in terms of the process I went through was not just about winning medals at all. It was very much an intensive, I think, in performance and personal development and well-being as well, to a degree. Although I also got it very wrong. I overtrained, and that was a challenge for me, and that led to other problems. So it was a big journey on every respect, physical, mental, emotional and spiritual.
I love that you've not just focused on the medal at the end, but the whole journey. You're clearly a very resilient person. Where do you think you find that strength from?
I don't know. I mean, honestly, I don't think it's necessarily innate. I think it's come through my circumstances, and we talk about nature nurture, but I think when we're thrown into some of the most difficult circumstances we might imagine for our life, or when we choose challenging circumstances, like I seem to have an inclination to do, then usually we're learning something in the process. And when we're learning something, we're all the time integrating new ideas. We're being exposed to new approaches, new perspectives. I think one of the biggest things that's helped me is just realizing that we are not what we think, that we do have more control over our mind than many of us would believe we do. I used to just think that my mind was me, whereas now I've realized I can I can change my mind. I can affect it, and that affects how I feel, and that enables me to be more flexible or have more mental agility to see situations in different ways and reframe them, and therefore go forward with more positivity than I might do otherwise.
That's such a powerful message to end on, because I think we so often focus on physical strength, but often forget about the mental strength, which is just as, if not more, important.
Yeah, and I have a reasonable amount of mental agility, and I love helping other people with that too, either through the speaking work that I do or coaching. And I think we all have it, honestly. I think it just needs training, like anything. When we go to a gym to train some muscles to get them stronger and bigger, we have to do the same with our mind, and that mental agility that we all have that we maybe don't realize we have can be trained for sure.
Karen, you have such an amazing story. It's been really incredible talking to you, and I can't wait to find out how your trip to the South Pole goes. Before we say goodbye, I'm going to ask you our four quickfire questions that we're going to be asking all our guests on the podcast. Is that okay?
Yep, go for it.
Okay. Can you name a woman who's inspired you?
Well, my mum inspires me. She's very different to me. She's not quite got the same explorer mindset as me, but she's got huge amounts of compassion and patience. So that inspires me. And there's a woman called Isabel Hutchinson, who was a Scottish explorer, who really was before her time. She lived in, I think it's the late 1800s, and she resisted all of the typical ways of expectations of her time for what a woman should do. And she chose to not marry and to step out from some of the normal things people are expecting of her. And she went off to Greenland and brought back huge knowledge of the botany of Greenland and of polar exploration into Scotland. So she's quite an inspirational woman from her era.
What's one piece of advice you'd give your younger self?
I think what I've already said, actually, you can create your own reality. Thoughts are real forces, and you don't have to be what you think you do.
What's the one thing you can't live without?
Well, clearly couldn't live without a very well-functioning body, my heart's beating. So my heart and my bike, I seem to not do very well once I don't have my bike around. I do love to ride.
Tell me one thing about you that would surprise people.
Most people don't know about another side of me. They hear about all these adventures and explorations, and it all seems very busy, busy. But I have another side which is fascinated by other approaches to healing and wellness. So I studied traditional Chinese medicine. I used to work for a while as an acupuncturist. I've studied various forms of energy medicine, vibrational healing techniques, and hypnotherapy. So all kinds of alternative approaches to health, which I like to practice myself as well, and is an important part of my life to keep in balance and keep my body performing.
That is so interesting. I grew up in Hong Kong, so I'm a little bit familiar with Chinese medicine. That's fascinating. I never would have guessed that about you.
Good. It was a surprise.
Amazing. Thank you so much for coming on our podcast, Karen. I've loved chatting to you.
Thank you so much.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please rate and review, as it helps people to find us. To find out more about Women of the Year, go to www.womenoftheyear.co.uk. The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Silicon Valley Bank UK. They're the financial partner to the businesses, founders, and investors shaping the innovation economy. The bank for the driven, bold, unstoppable visionaries like you, using technology to make our world better. Learn more at svb.com/UK.